Hey everybody, I wanted to just offer a couple quick notes before this episode on Uncanny Magazine. First, I wanted to say a big thank you to all of you who nominated The Skiffing Fanny Show for a Hugo. We obviously did make the final ballot, but we looked at our numbers and realized that we were, you know, pretty close, and that's, you know, honestly, that feels really good. And I really, really appreciate that you guys, you know, supported us and put us on your ballots. So thanks so much for that. I really appreciate that. Who knows what'll happen next year? It'll probably be crazy again, but, you know, whatever. The other thing I did want to say is thanks to the folks that have been supporting us on Patreon. We kind of are still kind of figuring it out, and it's been really nice to get people involved. If you're interested in supporting us there and getting some cool perks and whatnot, and also supporting some of the really cool projects we'd like to be able to do, which we just don't have funding to do, like translating interviews would be lovely, you can go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty and support us there. And as always, thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoy this episode.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5-4-3-2-1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Uncanny Magazine Year 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Of course you would do that, Paul. I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And we have three very special guests today in order of their sort of appearance, even though one of them is two people in the same Skype call. We have Michael Damian Thomas. Hello, Michael.
Hello, everybody.
Lynn Thomas. Hello, Lynn.
Hi there.
And Mitchy Trota. Hello, Mitchy.
Hi, everybody.
So we're here to talk about Uncanny Magazine Year 2, which is currently up on Kickstarter, and as of this recording, is only a few thousand dollars shy of the goal. So that's pretty exciting.
Yes. As of this moment, we are 83% funded after 1 week.
That's awesome, guys. Congrats.
Thank you.
So I'm sure by the time this goes up, it'll probably have crossed, but that's okay because there's lots of stretch goals and stuff. So the thing I want to start us off with is you've already done a full season, as it were, of Uncanny Magazine. You've had a lot of success, I think, as indicated on your Kickstarter page. Things have gone very well. You've got a lot of great authors. So I want to hear from you guys your assessment of how you feel about your first year on your new magazine. And I guess I'll start with you, Lynn.
Well, we're exceedingly proud of what we have done this year. It has been a rather big roller coaster ride, which is why it took me a second to figure out what I was going to say. There is something really joyous about finding stories that you absolutely love and finding poems and essays that make you want to punch the air, and being able to share them with the world. And we are thrilled with all of the work that we have been lucky enough to have sent to us that we've selected for publication. And, you know, we're very much looking forward to doing even more awesome stuff in year two.
Excellent. What about you, Mitchy? How do you feel about the very first year?
I still have to pinch myself to occasionally remind myself that this is actually my life now. I've loved science fiction and fantasy since before apparently I could even talk. My parents used to read everything from Tolkien to Dune to all sorts of stories to me when I was a kid. And the idea that I get to wake up in the morning, come back from my day job, and get to go through all these amazing stories and work with nonfiction that just really tickles my brain, and poetry that reminds me that, yes, I do actually like poetry, is absolutely incredible. The type of work that we've published is something that makes me proud every day, where I can point to the magazine and go, yes, this has my name on it. and you should read it because everything we have in here is absolutely awesome.
So, so obviously the first year, all of you feel really good about it, and you should because it has been actually a really phenomenal year. What can folks expect that may be a little bit different about the new year? I mean, what are you kind of hoping to achieve in your next bout?
Well, I mean, part of it is, you know, let's do more of the same, but better and slightly different, which is pretty much how anything ever evolves. The year two Kickstarter, you can see that we have some amazing lineup of authors, some of whom have been in the issue, been with us before. Others have not, and we're very excited to be working with them. We're still going to try to find the best covers we can. We are really dedicated to gorgeous artwork. You know, some new things this year, we are looking to expand the podcast a bit, which is pertinent to people listening right now, for lo, we are on a podcast. And we would like to get some more interviews and some neat stuff behind the scenes as a kind of an extra podcast, either, every month or every other month. So we're looking at that. Hopefully with some stretch goals, we may even be able to include our first webcomic as a regular feature, at least on the website. So, and that'd be done by Liz Argel, who is a fantastic writer and web comic person. And so, yeah, we have some exciting stuff planned for this year.
Webcomic would be very exciting.
Yes, she is planning a webcomic that will actually interact with that month's fiction.
Ooh, cool.
Exciting.
So hopefully that is our final stretch goal. Hopefully we'll reach it.
Well, let's hope that happens. So folks, if you're listening, make sure to go to the show notes and you can go to Kickstarter and you can support it and make that happen because that sounds really fun. So Mitchie, what about you? You have a different kind of angle on this. And I remember talking off podcast with you, you had mentioned your kind of story for Uncanny. And I thought that would be a good time for you to kind of talk a little bit about that.
What I love about Uncanny is that this is the type of fiction that keeps reminding me why I love the genre and why I'm inspired by it, because there's always something that is, it feels like I have read it before, it in a good way. It is the kind of story that, tickles all those spots that I love about science fiction and fantasy, but it's also showing me a different way of approaching the types of narratives that I might be familiar with, with their framework, with the characters, but they're approaching them from new ways. So I get to see the genre through new eyes every time I pick up a story, which is really, really what I love. And nonfiction is my wheelhouse. That is where I live. And the idea that we'll get to dig into even more, more really challenging and intriguing and engaging topics with writers who will give us fantastic nonfiction pieces is something that I think is extremely exciting.
So this is more directed towards Lynn and Michael. You've had experience editing magazines before. This is your first. Launching a new magazine, much less through a Kickstarter, is not a venture to be contemplated without a leap of faith, yes, as it were. So I was curious, looking back on how did the actual experience of running the first year of Uncanny match up with your expectations?
It was more work. I mean, in all bluntness, it was every time you add another ebook format, it's more work. The publishing side of it, we knew it would be a lot of work. I'm not sure we were quite prepared for how much work it turned out to be, but it's work that we enjoy, so it's okay. It's just because particularly at first, we were learning so many different systems and so many different programs and trying to figure out generating the ebooks and editing them appropriately format-wise for the different ebook formats and all of that. Because there was such a learning curve at the beginning, that was, that was an issue. And, we're also, at the same time, we're learning to run a small business.
Yeah, that's probably the stuff that has been luckily we've had some people who have been holding our hand and are always like, John Joseph Adams and Christy Yant from Lightspeed have been so helpful in answering questions.
They have been huge helps.
And, Neil Clark from Clark's World has also been great, and many of the Strange Horizons folks. So we have plenty of people who have given us advice throughout? Because, the stuff we knew, I mean, we still know how the basics of how to find a story, how to move a story along in the editorial process, how to put together the content of a magazine, how to pick a cover. I mean, these were all things that we'd done previously at Apex. But yeah, it, as Lynn said, and now we make ebooks, and now we get the ebooks to the vendors, and now we do this, and now we do, I mean.
And now we deal with taxes, and we deal with accounting and things like that. That's the stuff that was the big learning curve this time around.
Where we've benefited more than anything else is we got extremely lucky, and we got an amazing managing editor on board.
Yep.
And
aw, thank you.
Well, it's true, Mitchie, because we would be dead without you. Mitchie has saved our bacon in many ways. So, yep. And also the podcast team, by getting Erica Ensign and Stephen Schepansky and Deborah Stanish. I mean, it's just having such talented people working with us has made this possible. Otherwise, my goodness, this was a lot. Yeah. As Lynn said, this was a lot of work. It's been a lot of work, but it's been extremely enjoyable work. I mean, I don't want to sound like it. I mean, we are just loving doing this, and we're loving getting out these what we think are stories and essays and poems and covers and everything that are just amazing, and we want to share with the world. And we're so happy that we're at the end of year one, and every issue got out on time, everybody got paid, everybody, the reaction has been good from readers. So it's been a great year. Really happy great year for year one.
Okay, so we tagged Mitchie. So I want to turn to you and basically ask you the same question. How has been the first year of Uncanny been for you as managing editor?
I will second it's been a lot of work. I'm pretty sure our local coffee shop here in the neighborhood has come to recognize when I need to come in for the extra extra large cup of coffee when it's production week. But it's been fantastic because I get to use all of the skills that I picked up in my day job as being able to being able to edit and work with, to actually work with the creative side and merge it with working with the technical aspects of inputting all of the pieces into the website and then creating the PDF using design software that, I learned how to do as part of my day job. And it's just being able to learn how working a magazine like this actually is, something that I actually enjoy publishing. I really, really do when I'm working with material that I can be passionate about. And learning from Lynn and Michael about how to look at pieces of fiction and figuring out how to order things in the book and, how do we decide what is going to be released in the first half on the web and then in the second half. It's been a great learning curve for me in figuring out and understanding how it works with creative text as opposed to what I would do with my day job was a lot of articles for that were very profession specific or, trade specific. This is something that's creative and it's just a little bit different in that there are still things that I had to learn, but it wasn't completely unfamiliar territory, which I think really, really helped in terms of, not jamming up productions, during each month. It helped make sure that we were getting things out on time because I already came into it understanding what the general timeline needs to be in turning stuff around. And I think it's just going to get better. I think we are just going to keep getting better the more and more that we do this because we're now getting used to the beats of each production cycle. It's not something that we're, kind of learning how to juggle. We are now getting to the point where we can move into really interesting tricks and being able to move things along faster and maybe make more room for new things because we now know how to do the stuff we were doing last year.
Excellent. That all sounds great. I'm glad that the experience for the first year for the three of you has been so educational in a positive way, but I think I'm going to tag out to my partner here.
Well, yeah, so I thought it was interesting, Michael and Lynn were talking about how much they've relied in some respects on other folks who are running their own magazines. I mean, you mentioned John Joseph Adams and Neil Clark, and getting a lot of help from them in terms of things like ebooks and the kind of technical aspects. And I thought it was interesting because I don't know how many people who maybe aren't in on the end of things as you guys are would think about that element of the community as being so collaborative.
It's one of those things that, and we had this moment, especially at World Fantasy, where I think I was sitting there and I was talking to Cece Finlay, who'd just taken over on F at SF, and Lynn was talking to Sheila Williams of Asimov's, and I think Maria Mohanraj at the table and many others. And it was like, I was realizing, wow, we are just, this is the editors of short fiction. This is pretty much for us. This isn't a zero sum game. We look at this as a community. And if one of us thrives, all of us thrives, you know, and that's how we all have dealt with it. And, you know, we may have different tastes. We may have different ideas of how things should be done. And that's good. We're supposed to. But at the same time, we all realize it's important that as a community of editors and magazines and markets, that we recognize that we're all in this together. This is not a huge moneymaker. This is not something that anyone's getting rich off of. But all of us are here because we really love science fiction and fantasy. We really love short fiction. We love the concept of a magazine, whether it be a print magazine or an online magazine or an ebook. You know, this is just something that excites us all. And we love, and it's, we all realize we grow as a community if we share this information, if we work together and let all of our visions. It's like, you know, Lynn is very, you know, chatty with Trevor from Analog, and you know, we could not probably get two theories on short fiction different than Lynn's and Trevor's. But as people, they get along as editors because they understand this is what we do and we love this stuff, even if we like different types of stories. And that's good because we're supposed to like different types of stories. That's what differentiates us as markets. But, oh, no, I mean, it is beautiful that all the editors that we all get along and that we all like each other.
The two of you, especially Lynn and Michael, have a very strong mission and vision of what you like in fiction, what you like in a magazine, what fiction beats make you work. So I was curious if you could recapitulate that mission and vision for those listeners who have never foolishly actually read any of Uncanny, and how do you think, if at all, that mission and vision has changed actually having gone through a year of actually publishing a magazine?
Lynn, shall you use our tags?
Well, I mean, the short version is that we are all about passionate short science fiction and fantasy, fiction, poetry, provocative nonfiction. We have an investment in demonstrating all of the glory that can be had by investing in our diverse science fiction and fantasy culture.
Gorgeous prose.
And we are keen on gorgeous prose. I mean, this is something that is, it's, you know, we're not the only market, but it is particular to our taste that we actually really, really like pretty words. And we do differentiate between elegance and word salad. But it's something things that are well written are important to us.
And basically at the end of the day, we want you to have felt something when you read that. We want that story to stick with you because it evoked some strong feeling, you know, whether it be love, fear, whatever, just, we want you to have felt something from that experience. And that is to us an uncanny story, a little weird, a little bit off-putting, and hopefully from a point of view that maybe isn't your point of view. You know, we want people to jump in into a point of view that is not their own and see how gorgeous just all the different voices are that are possible in science fiction fantasy.
It kind of feels like we're building a culture of empathy one story at a time.
Something like that.
That's a phrase. Wow.
Culture of empathy one story at a time. Put that on a t-shirt.
That should be Uncanny Magazine, a culture of empathy one story
Mitchie,
at a time.
Get it to the t-shirt shop.
Get it to a t-shirt shop. We'll put it on a cookie.
A cookie?
That's a lot of words for it. That's going to be a big cookie, Mitchie.
I have no problem with this. These are awesome.
Especially if they have raisins along with the
chocolate
chips.
We are not starting.
Do not bring in the cookie wars.
This is a cookie war-free zone.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I forgot this podcast. We do not discuss the cookie wars. That is...
Yeah, that's in our bylaws. What are you doing?
Sorry.
We signed a treaty over this, Michael. What are you doing? But going back to that, that very clever phrasing, but I think that's an interesting thing, that short fiction as a means by which we can kind of explore lives that are not our own, and not to go into too much detail, but, you know, that is, I think, one of the kind of themes of the controversies this year, that there is a certain part of genre that really wants those experiences, and a side that maybe not as much. And I think that's interesting that that's kind of where you see Uncanny kind of pushing at, is trying to find those different experiences. And I guess, Mitchie, as managing editor, how is that from your perspective in terms of, and do you find it that at all difficult as an editor to kind of going through, because you probably see more than any other person on the planet that's not an editor, right? In terms of the number of stories you probably have to read.
Well, the amount of stories that come through during when we are open for submissions is absolutely staggering, but that number is incredibly encouraging because of the sheer number of different voices that I see coming into the magazine. There are people who are so passionate and believe deeply in what they're writing that they have sent their... Sorry, I think there seems to be some honking outside.
That's okay. It's Armageddon. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
But it's there are people who feel so passionately about their vision that they are willing to send it into the wild and hopefully be published and be read by people who they don't know whether or not the editors are going to enjoy their story enough to want to publish it. It is a great leap of faith to make when you send a piece of work out into the world. But the philosophy that Lynn and Michael have noted here is pretty much why I said yes to working on the magazine. This is exactly the kind of publication that I have always wanted to work on. It is why I am becoming, why I've become much more involved in science fiction and fantasy. I was kind of falling out of love with the genre a couple of years ago because I felt like I was reading the same thing. And while I was enjoying it, it wasn't giving me any new perspectives. It wasn't challenging me. And I love for my fiction to challenge me with different perspectives, to get me to think about things in a different way. And that is what we see coming into Uncanny. That is what we publish. And it is a really wonderful thing.
So now that the three of you have actually gone through a year of the magazine, are looking to go into a second year of publishing the magazine, what sort of advice do you have to, I mean, there's a wealth and wealth of small presses, micro-publishers, self-publishers, the whole, all sorts of creative people to also trying to burgeon on this market. What sort of, having gone through a year of putting forth a magazine, what advice do you have for people who want to put their own shingle out?
For fiction or just in people wanting to get published in Uncanny, yeah. You mean?
Well, that's actually a separate question entirely.
Okay, we'll so not people who want to be published, but people who wish to publish.
Yes. So I actually have two questions. Let's go with the first one first.
Spreadsheets are your friend?
Oh, no. Are we talking publishers or are we talking writers now?
We're talking people who want to hang out their shingle and go into the publishing side of things.
Ah, okay.
So the first rule of publishing is that if you want to make... I mean, there's a really old publishing joke that has made the rounds a lot, which is that if you wish to make a little bit of money at publishing, start with a lot. It's a lot of work. You'll need to be exceedingly organized, and you will spend far more of your time emailing people and chasing things down and trying to meet deadlines and dealing with technical stuff than you will with the creative side of things. I mean, I would say that the actual fun part of getting to find stories and poems and nonfiction that make us go woo.
Probably about 30%.
Yeah, I was going to say 25 to 30% of what we do is that. The rest of it, the other 75%, is running a small business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of work. So, get good advice, be nice to people, and do what you say you will do.
I think also it is important to really consider the people who you want to work with. Because if that team is really going to be a huge part of your success, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. failure, Having people who are, you know, who are passionate, not only passionate, but skilled at what they do is absolutely necessary. And having, being aware of the perspectives that your team brings to the project, having a diverse and well-represented staff is only going to help you.
Well, it's like, okay, I'm now going to dive. I'm just watching with Caitlin a Phineas and Ferb recently where Doofenshmirtz does become a governor of the tri-state area. Now this is going somewhere. But, you know, every episode, you know, it is him trying to gain power, is trying to take over and be evil and all this other stuff. He gets it, and then he realizes all this paperwork, and it's no longer fun. And this is something with a lot of creative endeavors. A lot, you know, it's that you have to have the passion. We get into it for the passion, but once you're there, you quickly realize that you still need to maintain the passion and the love and the creativity and all that. But eventually, there's going to be paperwork, and there's going to be things that are just not fun. Maybe there is that person who goes, wow, I love answering emails. I love emailing people. Emailing to see where that thing is great. You know, but even, you know, from that down to, you know, the rejection emails, the, you know, getting the line edit emails into a way which makes sense to the person you're working with. I mean, it is a lot of little work, making sure all of your money is there and that your contracts are right. And, you know, and as we brought up in another interview recently, there is no such thing as editor school. There isn't publisher school. So, you know, there is no clarion for folks like us.
Yeah, I think there's one book publishing program in New York, and that's it.
Occasionally you get like someone who offers an online class. But, you know, for the most part, we're all kind of feeling our way. This is one of the reasons why we are this close community that shares information, because mm-hmm. all of us are kind of, we come in with passion and then we have to figure out how to actually do things. Mm-hmm. And that's tricky. And that's also why you see, you know, if you look at Rallin right now, you can go to a dead market thing in there. And it's a website that lists all the markets, and the dead market list is like frightening. It is frightening how long it is. And a lot of it are, you know, sometimes people just couldn't get their business model to work, but often it's people get into it. They're passionate on day one, and then they realize, wow, this is just
a lot of work,
and I don't have money, and I don't have the brain, and I need to walk away.
Okay, so on that summer, let's jump to a happier note. So, okay, yes. So let's say that Jane, a writer listening to this podcast, wants to submit to Uncanny. What advice do you have for Jane?
Thank you. Thank you, Jane Ryder. We love to see your submission. Number one, and I say this as someone who was a former managing editor somewhere and, you know, with my job right now, please read the submission guidelines. That is part one. You know, we don't even need to talk about what kind of story it is first. Read the submissions guidelines and please follow our guidelines first. Lynn, you do part two.
Part two, send the best version of your best story on your best day. Have other people read it. Revise it. Make sure that all of the things that you want to be there are there. Make sure that the things that are there lend themselves to the shape of the story. It's important to make sure that the structure of your story and the tone of your story and the characters in your story and the plot in your story all work together, and they aren't pushing up against one another in opposite directions.
And I mean, some people don't have to have other readers. I mean, every process is different, but, you know, we like to see the story that we think, you know, the writer, they are proud of the story. It is the best version of that story that they can produce. And we want to read stories that are not designed for us, but are once again, or that writer is like, this is the story I want to tell with the voice that I want to use.
Yeah, it's about sort of finding your authenticity as a writer in and of yourself.
Truthiness.
Yeah, well, it is about truthiness. I mean, in the sense that the stories that tend to stand out for us and get our attention are the ones that feel truthy, as Stephen Colbert would say, because they come from the perspective of the person that is writing them, and the only person who can write that story in that particular way is the person doing the writing. We want the stories that are yours to tell. We don't necessarily, you know, we see lots and lots and lots of variations on well-known stories. I mean, we've published variations on fairy tales. We have published variations on different SFNL tropes that are out there.
Spaceships, zombies,
and zombies, telepathy. Oh my. All of these things are tropes that you can use. But what's important is that the story that you're telling, even if you're using a really well-trod trope, is one that only you could tell.
The voice is what matters to us. Yeah. At Uncanny, it's all about it. It is about the voice.
I would add to that is, yes, while we are not looking for, you know, something that is, you know, crafted for us, because that authenticity of voice is so important, it is always a really good idea to go through what we have published on in Uncanny so you can get a feel for the type of stories that we look for. They're all, you know, they are all their own individual voices, but in my experience, it has always been a good idea to familiarize yourself with the publication that you want to submit to, mm-hmm, because there is a feel, there is a, you know, you can get a good idea of what kind of story is, mm-hmm, an uncanny story if you read the stories that we have published.
And to be blunt, if your story is filled with misogyny or racism or something like that, not for us. Don't do that. We don't want to see that story.
That's just not of interest to us.
No.
Also, please don't do that to our submissions readers.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, I feel like that would be very not fun.
It hasn't been as big a problem with Uncanny. When we were at Apex, that was a huge problem.
Because it was a horror market, we got a lot of the
oh, okay,
really disturbing stuff would come through.
There's some stuff that was just very misogynistic. Yeah. Very, very misogynistic.
And when you're a female editor of a horror market, that makes it so that people try extra hard, which isn't always pleasant.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is a weird thing with horror. For some reason, there's a conflation with, you know, horror, which is, you know, meant to scare us, and what I sometimes just refer to as torture porn,
mm-hmm,
which is just meant to kind of gross you out, which David Anandel would completely disagree with me. He will say that they're both part of the same genre, and I say they are drastically different things, because being grossed out and being terrified are not the same emotions, and I don't think they come from the same part of the brain.
No, but now we're getting to a very complicated one. I mean, because horror is often about a violation. I mean, and that has to be some kind of violation. So, I mean, or some kind of breaking of a taboo. I mean, taboo. There are things there, but obviously for us, we have certain buttons and things where we're like, no, that is not horrific to us. It is just hateful, and we need to move on.
Well, it just goes firmly into the no thank you category. And yeah. I mean, one of the reasons that Uncanny is not a horror market. So, we may publish dark stories, but we don't publish horror. And, you know, we were joking after a year and a half of almost 2 years of Apex that, you know, I needed a unicorn chaser, and we ended up with a space unicorn chaser.
So to be fair, at Apex, we had dragged it closer to more, it was more dark fantasy than it was ever horror.
Yeah.
I know for me, racism is something that no. I am a woman of color. That is something that I just cannot ignore in my fiction. So.
And just so people who may not be familiar, I'm assuming that when we say like racism and sexism, we mean like unchecked. It's not being used for some sort of critical purpose.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you can take a look at Sophia Samatar's story, which we published this year, which is a take on Heart of Darkness, which goes and looks at racism very specifically from a very specific point of view and takes on the issues inherent in racism from the perspective of she flips it and tells it from the perspective of a young woman of color. So that kind of story is definitely of interest.
Yeah, we can have stories that deal with colonialism. It's just more that they can't be unchecked, unthought of colonialist BS kind of, ooh, that's not good.
Right. Challenging versus reinforcing.
Yeah, it's about interrogating tropes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suspect for some that's actually, it can be a very difficult thing to know the difference, but it should seem obvious, but I think there probably is a line that is a little bit fuzzy for some.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but that's a thing to work on. If you're a writer person, gotta work on that. Number one way, read stuff.
No, read stuff, and Writing the Other is a good resource book.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Well, on that note, Are there any other resources that you think that writers who, you know, may want to check out? I mean, Writing the Other is a great resource, but are there any others that you find particularly useful?
I would say that it's certainly worthwhile to check out things like the We Need Diverse Books blog, which takes on a lot of these issues and does a lot of recommendations for reading. I mean, the key for dealing with these kinds of issues in particular, I think, other than going through something like writing the other or looking at other similar workshops, is to read really widely and to read widely work that is written by people who are not just like you. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that is in and of itself one of the major things that you can do as a reader that can help you as a writer.
There was also a resource that I just stumbled across recently that I thought was actually really useful. It's a Tumblr website called Writing with Color. So it's dedicated to writing and resources centered on racial and ethnic diversity. There's advice given, book recommendations, some critique and feedback on, you know, where people mm-hmm. will submit questions about, you know, hey, I'm writing this character and I'm not sure if what I'm doing is actually a good idea because this and this. And it's actually, there are some really good, thoughtful answers and perspectives being given. So that is a resource that I would definitely advise people to check out.
That I think that'll be really, really useful for folks who maybe want to challenge themselves in trying to write different kinds of characters and people who perhaps are a little reluctant or afraid to do so because they're afraid of just screwing up, which comes with its own problems, but yeah.
There was an interesting conversation Gail Simone, the comic book writer, was having over Twitter a little while ago, where she was talking about her, the thing that she was known for was coming up with the description, women in refrigerators, which is basically when bad things are made to happen to female characters in order to give the male characters motivation to do, you know, whatever, to propel the narrative forward. And it was, you know, she was having to make it clear again that it's not that nothing bad, it's not that she doesn't think that nothing bad should ever happen to your female characters, but you need to interrogate why you are doing, you know, why you are having this particular bad thing happen to them. Is it going to be part of their character evolution? Does it play a part in the narrative? Does it objectify your female character? Are you just having something terrible happen to her in order to motivate your male character to be a hero or to demonstrate just how bad your villain is? So there are all these little things where you're looking at it and you're thinking, you know, like, it's not that you can't do it. You just need to be in, you need to think about why you are including those elements in your story.
Yeah, why is a good question. That, I mean, that's something I tell my, I don't teach literature, first off. I mean, I teach literature, but I don't teach writing. But it is something when it comes to making arguments, is if the question of why is not answered yet, you haven't done your job making your argument. Because you're missing key pieces of the argument. If I'm at the end and I'm like, well, why? Why is this the way you see it? And that's a great, I think that's a really useful question to ask if you're writing fiction, right? Is why are you doing the things you're doing?
Or you're writing anything.
Or if yeah. you're writing anything. Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, one of the questions that recurs for me as an editor is, so what? Generally speaking, when I'm working with a story or a nonfiction essay for that matter, you can put forth your thesis, you can put forth your central theme, you can put forth your X, then Y, then Z. But for me, if your story or your piece doesn't answer the fundamental question of, so what? Yes, this thing happened to that character. What has the character learned from it? What is the result of this? Why should I care? If you aren't answering those questions in your fiction, or in your nonfiction for that matter, it's less likely to appeal to me, because that's what interests me. It's not so much about, you know, building a better gizmo to get you to the moon. It's about, so what? So you built a better gizmo. How does that affect things? Why should I care? Those are the types of things that interest me as a reader. And, you know, that's something I picked up back in the midst of time when I was in library school, when I kept writing papers, on the history of like libraries and being like, well, this thing happened. That was the whole paper, was this thing happened. And my advisor would be like, so what? because that's only half the paper. You demonstrate that the thing happened, but then you also have to talk about the impact of the thing. And the impact is where the emotional core of the story often lies. So that's one of the things that I think is really, it's important to me as a reader.
Or the essay.
Or the, yeah.
Yeah, and answering that question, I feel like, I mean, it's, if we're talking about writing a history paper, right, it's mm-hmm. one thing to write down, like, World War II happened, right, just to mm-hmm. pick the obvious example. But the more compelling question is, well, what is the impact on a thing, whatever it is you're going to be focused on? Because we all know World War II happened. We can all go read a history book that says it happened. But what impact on the world did that have, or did mm-hmm. on a certain mm-hmm. people, right? That's the more interesting question, I think. And if you're answering that question, you're doing a greater service because you're actually expanding the value of the knowledge. This is the academic in me talking.
But. No, it's okay. It's one of the useful things with Mitchie working on our nonfiction is Mitchie's also very good with, because I'm just a history guy and I can get very excited about history. Mitchie is much quicker to ask, why should I care about this thing? Why does this history matter to me?
That's because I had that, actually, I had a lot of that critique with my nonfiction work. And that was something that I had to work on a lot, was the, okay, so there's this really cool thing and it happened. So why does it matter? Mm-hmm. I had some really, I was very lucky that I had some great professors in school who would push me to explain why does this matter. Whether it's personal nonfiction or a critical nonfiction essay, there has to be that element of emotional resonance. And why, you know, why do you care? Like, one of the things that I loved so much about the Folding Beijing story that we had in the magazine last year was that there was a really cool premise of a city that would fold in on itself, and there would be different, you know, different levels of the city that was visible and above ground during different times of day. But what really mattered was, what impact did that have on the lives of the characters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, I think that question is really, really difficult, and probably necessarily so, because that gets at the deeper parts. I mean, in fiction, right? Gets at the deeper parts of what makes us human, or mm-hmm. what we think makes us human. Who the hell knows? I mean, MIT just made a robot with human-like reflexes, so that's going to go away soon. But that is right. That what makes us human are the emotional components and how those impact us and what it does to us, versus a kind of very stilted view of the world where those impacts aren't there. I mean, I think of like old school science fiction where you just have the gizmo and the doodad, where they're using this amazing technology and it's like they don't, like, they're not even having, there's no conversation about the fancy doodad, right? It just sort of, like, they got faster than light travel somehow out of a, you know, tin can with some old oil in it, and like, no big deal, right? They're flying faster than light and they have ray guns and aliens with six eyes, but there's no discussion of what that's doing to people. So, which is a weird thing, because science fiction, right, this is in the era when UFOs are like the big scary, and like, oh, the aliens are coming and abducting us in 1947 as Roswell and the aliens landed. That would have a huge impact if aliens showed up.
Yes.
To be fair, the day the Earth stood still did actually address this, and we all freaked the frick out and tried to kill it. So that may be one of two responses. Oh, God.
Paul, you were saying?
No, I think that science fiction has matured and changed since those days of the 50s, where we just had the gimmick story, the one beat story, the very narrow is kind of a bad word to say, the very focused story on just the sense of wonder, like, ooh, we of course have this. Whereas I think, and Uncanny is part of the tradition, I think our fiction, science fiction, has matured and is asking more of the reader and more of the authors.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, I mean, by the 50s, it was already there. It was already, you know, you go back and read an old issue of Gold's Galaxy, you're going to, you know, you'll be seeing stories that are about, that are impacting the human condition with this stuff. It's already, by the time you get to New Wave, that it's more of the focus than anything is, how does this change the human condition? How does this affect the human condition? Mm-hmm. I think the story, which is just the biz, you know, the wowie look at this thing. Isn't this cool? It's got to be more than that, you know, and you can do a lot with that. I mean, not everything has to be a deep digression into the psyche of the human nature. I mean, because you can show a story which is just fun crap happening to someone in a spaceship or on a quest. But you still have characters that develop and change from point A to B. That's what makes a story interesting.
Yeah, the things aren't nearly as interesting as what happens to people when they use the things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In any case, we should probably close out here pretty soon because you all have lives to get to.
Yes.
Supposedly.
Oh, no. Well, by life, you mean constant work. We have issue 6 we need to finish. We have the Kickstarter we have to continuously run.
Well, you know, that's one form of life, you know.
There does need to be dinner before work.
There does need to be dinner. I love dinner. But it is late. I already had dinner. But in any case, so I'll have a link in the show notes to the Kickstarter, so folks can find it. You can also Google it in case you don't want to go to the show notes, or you can go to a billion places like Uncanny Magazine. We'll have a place for you to find it there. But is there anything else you guys want to plug or point to before we close out?
Well, issue 6 will be out on September 1st. It'll be featuring lots of neat stuff, including stories by Paul Cornell.
As well as Liz Argel and Ken Schneier. Kenneth Schneier, sorry. And Keffi Curley.
Yes.
And Isabel Yap.
Yes.
And with Keffi's story and with Isabel's stories, they are novelettes, so they are extra long.
That's right.
And good for your soul and brain.
Yep.
And Mitchie, what nonfiction are we featuring?
We have an essay. We have essays by Diana Foe and by Stephen Silver and David Schwartz. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing
David
that correctly.
David J. Schwartz. Yep.
And me.
And you. And I'm looking forward to reading it.
I'm looking forward to getting it to you. So.
Hint, hint, wink, wink.
Yes. And poetry we have by
Rose Lemberg, Jennifer Crow,
Amal Amaltar. It's a reprint poem, but it's a beautiful reprint poem that had been in the Wisconsin Chronicles a few years ago, so it's kind of not been out there, and now it will be.
Yay.
And then
Dominic Parisien.
Perfect, perfect. So all of this comes out on the 1st of September.
Yes, yep. With an awesome cover by comic book artist Matthew Dow Smith, who's worked on many major titles and is currently working on X-Files and just recently was a comic artist for the Doctor Who comics.
Mm-hmm.
So
it is a really gorgeous cool. piece of art. Gorgeous.
That sounds really exciting. The art for the Uncanny stuff has been really, really awesome, by the way.
Thank you.
So, thank you. That's something we care deeply about, too.
And, yeah. I am determined to cosplay that cover from issue 4 by Tran. Because it is amazing.
Oh, and I'm trying to find it. I'm trying to find it right now.
It's the woman on the
one.
Yeah.
Are you gonna actually get the cat, the giant cat though?
I would walk around with a giant stuffed leopard. I'd look for a stuffed leopard animal, and that would go with the costume.
I would pay to see that.
I would photograph that.
And Paul would, because he always has a camera.
That is true.
Maybe when I go to my first Worldcon, I will make this happen.
Excellent.
An American road trip.
Yeah.
We're going to do a convoy there from Chicago. We're going to have CBs. We're all going to have CB handles. It's going to be great.
Oh, my goodness.
Lord.
Now you know what our staff meetings sound like.
This will be the hashtag space unicorn shenanigans really is going to be getting a workout.
Yeah.
Yep. So, and otherwise, you know, the year 2 Kickstarter is rolling and, you know, we're asking for less money this year because thankfully we do have a lot of funding sources that we've been developing with advertising, Patreon, subscriptions through the good folks at Waitlist Books. The year 2 Kickstarter is, as we said earlier, going well. And some of our solicited authors for year 2 include Shauna McGuire, Aliette Baudard, Ursula Vernon, Scott Lynch, Catherine M. Valenti, Elizabeth Baer, Mary Robinette Kowal, Maria Devana Headley, Rachel Swirsky, Max Gladstone. Well, you start saying them rather than giving me
Mala Botar, Lissa Wong, and Carmen Maria Machado. We also have solicited nonfiction from Chris Cluey, Javier Grigio Marxwatch, Tansy Rainer Roberts, Jim Hines, Mark Oshiro, and Sarah Kuhn, and poetry from Sophia Samatar, Isabel Yap, Sonia Tafe, and M. Sereno, as well as cover art from the amazing Julie Dillon, Galen Dara, and Katie Shuttleworth, who also designed our rockin' Space Unicorn logo.
So plenty of good things coming for year two, and we're going to open submissions soon. So plenty of hope, and hopefully we will reach stretch goals, so there will be more slots for the submissions that are coming in.
That's right, because every stretch goal that we reach means that there are more slots specifically for unsolicited submissions.
Awesome, awesome. And so by the time this episode drops, there'll be something like 17 days left,
yes,
roughly,
mm-hmm,
because this is supposed to go out on a Monday following this. So that's plenty of time for you to go check out the Kickstarter page. So just go to uncannymagazine.com and you'll just see it right on the side there.
Hey.
Well, so thanks so much, Michael, for joining us on the show to talk about the second year of Uncanny Magazine and the things that are coming.
Well, thank you for having us.
And thanks, Lynn.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Welcome. And thank you, Mitchie.
Thank you.
Awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.